Thank you for the introduction. The topic, obviously, is accurate sound reproductions in a living room, in a home. It has always been, since the loudspeaker design was always, well, not always, but for much of my life, a hobby. My career was someplace else. I basically designed and built loudspeakers for myself, for my own personal amusement, and even still today, that's what I'm doing. And on my website, I basically share what I have learned with enough detail so that other people can build it themselves, try out, see whether what I'm saying is actually true, and they can confirm it or not. But that's really my background. And in a way, that's been, I think, a big advantage, because I did not have to design loudspeakers to make a living. So I was not bound by marketing considerations and could basically explore what seemed to be the directions one should go with loudspeakers there. So since I'm also married and I have a wife, and she has certain inputs on what goes into my living room, and I think that's true with for other people as well there, there have been pretty strong influences to keep the size as small as possible. So I've always tried to do just that and see how small can they be. And as it turns out, in hindsight, I will tell you that I think one should design acoustic point sources, or very acoustically small sources, and not that going big and large boxes is not necessarily the step in the right direction there. So with that much of an introduction here, this here is an example of the living room in our house. You see four speakers in there, D and M dipoles and monopoles, and we'll talk about it in detail more. But I just wanted to point out, this is California, so it probably looks very different from the U.S. as far as from England here, as far as the living room is concerned. But to the audiophile, I now coming through the door into this room, there are a few things standing out right away. First of all, there are windows, big windows, left and right. There's a fireplace there. There is a lack of absorbers, acoustic treatment, and various things that you read about and find in many rooms that are dedicated to audio and to listening. My philosophy has always been that sound should be part of my normal living enjoyment, and shouldn't require a special room, special setup there. And so part of the development of loudspeakers that I pursued was to find an answer or a solution that would work in a room like this, for example. And I have had different places that I lived in, but the goal was basically the same. Now, here is a very important point that I want to make right away. When you play a recording over two loudspeakers, all you can hope to get is an illusion, something happening between your ears. Because this is not stereo, is not the same like playback over headphones, like in a binaural recording where you have a dummy head with microphones at the eardrums and you play back those signals then over headphones. So you get an exact reproduction of the acoustic situation that was in real life. It is also not wave field reconstruction, where you may have a whole lineup of loudspeakers all around you, and you're physically trying to reconstruct the actual wave field in terms of pressure and direction of particle velocities at the place where you're listening to. Stereo is two loudspeakers, and it right away has a problem, because each loudspeaker I hear with both ears, something that is typically not happening in real life situation. If you hear a person speaking, both ears get the signals, but there isn't a crosstalk in the sense like I get if I wanted to reproduce that person speaking over two loudspeakers in the form of a phantom image. So it's inherently something unnatural, and but the processor between the ears is reconstructing or giving us a phantom image and giving us the illusion of something happening that physically is not really happening. Okay. Now, in order for this illusion to be really solid and not be given away, we have to minimize any confusing cues. I always compare it to a magician's act. There's a stage magician who has this young lady in a box, and he is cutting that lady into two pieces. At least that's the way it looks. But the magician is basically very careful not to give you any cues that would make you think he is not cutting her in two. Now, you know in your mind and say, well, it's not going to happen. There's not going to be any blood. You know that. But the illusion is so good that you have really hard time saying, now, how is it possible? What is he really doing? Okay. And stereo, in a way, is something very similar to that. Okay, so it's very important to avoid cues that tell you we are not there, we are not listening to this orchestra here. There are certain cues that we know are misleading. Everyone knows that the on-axis frequency response, say the free field response, should not have too many variations, wiggles, peaks, dips in there. We know that. We also know there shouldn't be resonances in loudspeakers. Resonances mean there is energy stored, which is in time released more gradually. Nevertheless, resonances are pretty much in most loudspeakers these days. When you have a vented system, you have a built-in resonance. Another cause for misleading cues is nonlinear distortion, which is the generation of new sounds that were not in the original recording. And another source that gives the loudspeaker away is diffraction, secondary radiation off the edges of the box or the cabinet there. They tell you that you're listening to a loudspeaker and not to the real thing. There are also confusing cues that are contributed by the room, because we usually listen to loudspeakers in rooms. We may measure them under free field conditions or in an anechoic room there, but then they end up being listened to in a living room there. And the major cues that the room contributes are the modes and resonances at low frequencies. Again, well known. It can get very boomy in a room, I think more so in Europe than in America because of the home constructions here. You use rooms with brick and concrete. In the US, it's often just sheetrock and plywood. So the characteristics are different, excuse me. But these are giving you cues that you're listening in a room, the room is contributing. There is also the loudspeaker as it's set up in the room causes reflections. Sound is bouncing off the sideboard, ceiling, floor. And those can give you misleading cues. You all know if you put a pair of speakers too far over to one corner, the stereo image will not be nice and symmetrical. It gets pulled over to one side. It also depends how far away you are, like how much the reflection is delayed. It also depends on the spectral content of the reflections. Like if you have absorbers at the wall, it will change the sound. Not necessarily make it better, but it will change it. And of course, it depends on the characteristics of the room itself. How fast is sound decaying in the room? All these can give you misleading cues. And the game is really, in sound reproduction, to minimize those cues. Then there are some cues that are not, well, not everybody would agree on that they are important, but I list them here, and the number one is the off-axis frequency response of a loudspeaker. I think this is the one really overlooked factor that is to me, it's just amazing how important it is, but we have sort of ignored it. And then there's a floor reflection, and various people have different opinions about floor reflections. They are always there. Floor reflection is there right now as I'm speaking. You have a floor reflection of my voice here. You have it whenever you talk to another person. A child has it. It's at a different frequency as it is later on in life as a child grows there. So floor reflection is a fact of life. It's always there. And I think the way perceptually we use the floor reflection is primarily to locate the height of a source, whether it's high or low, to the floor by the delay of the floor reflection there. Okay. All right. And here comes now what I would say as state as a claim or maybe hypothesis. I'm saying that it is possible to minimize the confusing cues from the loudspeaker and the room. And in order to do that, there are basically three things that have to be done. One is the loudspeaker has to be set up symmetrical so that the symmetry of the reflections relative to the direct sound. Reflections from the room surfaces have to have a minimum delay. In other words, speaker, they have to have a minimum distance. And the spectrum of the reflection should be the same as the spectral content of the direct sound. And let me say something more about this. For the spectrum of the reflections to be the same as the direct sound, we have to have loudspeakers that have a frequency-independent polar response. In other words, they have to radiate in all directions, in whatever direction they radiate in. It has to be the same frequency response like on axis. Now, there are only a few types of loudspeakers that will do that. Number one is, of course, an omnidirectional loudspeaker. It's like having a light bulb, a bare light bulb that shines light every direction, sideways, upwards, down, okay, omnidirectional. The other form of loudspeaker that has uniform off-axis response is a dipole, perfect dipole. And in terms of a light analogy, you could think of two flashlights back to back, one shining this way, the other one shining that way. Okay. And a third form is a cardioid loudspeaker, which is really just a combination of the omni and the bidirectional one. Now, for the reflections to be have the same spectrum content as a direct sound, of course, it's important that the reflection comes from surfaces that do not absorb or diffuse the sound in a frequency-dependent fashion. So if I put an absorber here and it absorbs the high frequencies, then the spectrum coming back from here will have less high frequencies. It's like turning down the tweeter, right? The direct sound comes here, the reflected has a tweeter turned down. The symmetry and the delay of the reflection, another parameter that is important here, is that we have to set up the loudspeaker symmetrical. Like if I had two loudspeakers, they shouldn't be set up over in that corner here, but they should be here in the center of the room. And furthermore, the loudspeaker should have some minimum distance from the walls. Like you shouldn't put the loudspeaker right against the wall, but at least a meter out or so. And that is this 1 meter, which means a 6 millisecond about time delay of the reflection, is empirical that I have found over time applies to really any type of loudspeaker, not just dipoles or omnis or any box speakers. They all improve if you get them out into the room. There's something just in our perception that tells us when you put a speaker against a room, or even worse, if you make it flush with the wall there, the sound comes off the wall. There's something unnatural happening here. Okay. Now, in my particular room, since it's fairly long, I have a setup here where, for instance, I have two types of loudspeakers, dipoles, which are these here, and monopoles, these loudspeakers. And listening position A is at the apex of an equilateral triangle for both types of loudspeakers. This is sort of the critical sweet spot, the listening position I use a lot. But there's a further place back here, place B, where I also do a lot of listening. But in either case, we are symmetrical with respect to the room. And here again is a picture of the room with the way it actually looks physically. Here you see the two seats A, the one close, and B, the one further away. And let's take a look at the two loudspeakers that I'm talking about here. There is one is a monopole, that's this unit here, schematically shown here. A 6-inch driver firing upwards, 2-inch driver firing forwards, crossover at a kilohertz, so fairly low frequency. Then there's a woofer, see over here on the side, with a downward firing 10-inch driver crossed over at 100 hertz. Okay. Now, this here is monopole only up to a certain frequency because eventually this 2-inch tweeter becomes directional and points forward. That occurs in the order of 3-4 kilohertz in that region. But up to that frequency, it's quite uniform monopole. So here you see at low frequencies, it's full circle, and at high frequencies, it's forward directional. The larger speaker behind it is a dipole, and it's also a three-way system, two woofers here, 10-inch woofers, 8-inch mid-range drivers, and two tweeters back-to-back. And the arrows indicate which way the cones move here. So you see dipole action. Okay, I will say more about those speakers later on. Now, clearly, what is always of interest is to measure the response in the room of those two loudspeakers. And here you see a frequency response measurement at listening position A, in other words, the critical point there. And here is for the left dipole, the right dipole. And as we compare the two, we certainly see differences. The lower curve here is the time is the frequency response measured in a 200 millisecond time window, so fairly long time window, but still not long enough to give full resolution, for instance, at low frequencies. Room modes, room resonances have a bandwidth in the order of 3-4 hertz or so. With 200 milliseconds, you get maybe 5 hertz resolution or so. This upper curve is just the average of this lower curve. Now, for the monopole, it's the same situation. We see the response is different. It's also different between left and right. And here the top curve is the average curve, and this one here is the actual frequency response curve. So I would say most people would look at this and say, huh, these speakers need a little help there. So there probably should be some equalization taking place. This thing obviously rolls off at high frequencies. Left and right speaker maybe should be equalized differently. But then keep in mind that what we are seeing here in these graphs is really a record of what happened during 200 milliseconds of putting out sound. So these data here that we're showing contains the not only the direct sound from the speaker, but also the reflections from the room, how the sound bounces around, interferes with itself, therefore these deep notches there, which are interferences, and peaks is where the sound adds up in frequency. So this is sort of a past record, but when we listen, we don't listen to in 200 hertz chunks. We listen and it's a continuum flow of sound. So this here is not necessarily the best way of looking at the response at position A here. And so I think it's important to look also what happens to the direct sound and the reflections in time. And now to measure that, little introduction here. First of all, when I say reflections, here's an example. This is a little model that I built. Here you have a dipole loudspeaker, sort of like the one that you saw in the photograph. And this is a room corner, the floor here, side wall and rear wall. And you see all these images in the surfaces there. Now, acoustically speaking, each one of these images makes sounds. So for instance, here, this image down below gives you the floor reflection. This speaker here on the side gives you the side wall reflection. This one here, the pointing downward speaker, gives you a sound coming to your listening position, which is bouncing between the side wall and the floor. This one back here, it's a rear wall and the side wall. This one, rear wall, side wall, and floor. Here is rear wall and floor. This is just from the rear wall. Okay. Now, I know it's popular in audiophile circles to talk about, oh, the reflection from the side wall. Well, this is just one of many. Or when you talk about dipoles, people are very concerned about the rear wall reflection. Again, keep in mind it's one of many only. Same with the floor reflection. These are just reflections in the corner. Now you have a ceiling. This whole thing is mirrored in the ceiling. Now you have a wall over here, the other corner. It's mirrored over there. So many, many reflections, and it's by no means that you could say that only the side wall, the floor, and the rear are the one that dominates. In practice, when you're making actual measurements, you'll see they are not necessarily negligible. So the way to measure these, is to use a tone burst, shape burst here with a Blackman window. When you look at the spectrum, this is a spectrum on the frequency scale, has about an octave bandwidth. And this curve down below here is the envelope of this curve on a logarithmic scale. This is really calculated mathematically. It's the magnitude of the analytic signal. That's what this is down here. And it shows the envelope up there. And it's this one down here that we'll look at when we look at reflection, or when I look at reflection. So you'll see here, again, our two loudspeakers. The left loudspeaker with this big spike here, that's a direct signal. This is for a 3 kilohertz tone burst. And this is, the time axis here is 50 milliseconds. The next spike is the floor. Okay. Then these various spikes here, don't ask me which is which. I have done analysis in the corner, and there's some correlation between when you expect which reflection to occur and with what magnitude. But in a real room, you don't have mirror-like surfaces. You have objects. So it's not as pretty and simple. And you can also see between the left and the right speaker, there are differences in the reflection. Now when we look at the monopole, here again is a direct signal, floor reflection, and then a whole bunch of other things there. So let's not make the floor reflection just the most important one, what's happening to all of these here. Now, the interesting thing is if we take this 50 millisecond time record and look at what is the spectral content of this thing here. And we see that here, this is for the dipole on top, frequency axis. You see the smooth curve, that's the original tone burst. And the wiggly curve is actually the direct tone burst plus all the reflection. So it still follows pretty closely to the direct signal. That is because the reflections in this case here have very much the same spectral content like the direct sound. Here you see a similar thing for the monopole. Signal-to-noise ratio is not as good here as it is up there because basically these drivers cannot handle quite as large signals. So this is just a peculiarity of the measurement. Now, here comes the really, to me, I have to say, very surprising observations when I first built these two types of loudspeakers, because I built them for different purposes. I wanted to study diffraction effects. I wanted to look at a point source, which I know has no diffraction effects, no cabinet diffractions, and compare it to the dipole, which has also really no diffraction effects. But that we would have to discuss that in more depth there to see that. But I wanted to just empirically compare the two there, if there was any difference in imaging in particular, because if the diffractions are different there, that it should show up in the preciseness and the accuracy of the imaging. But what really surprised me was the following observation here, that these two loudspeakers, the dipolar and the monopolar loudspeaker, sound almost identical in terms of their spectral balance and clarity, despite the differences that I just showed you, and I only gave you an example of it. I did many more measurements here. But despite the differences in measured room response and burst response, these two, in principle, very different loudspeakers, a monopole and dipole, sound so similar that many people who have sat down and said and give them a switch and say, okay, now switch back and forth between the two. After a very short time, they're confused, which one am I listening to, which one. And people have gotten up to walk over to put their ear to the speaker to see which one is it now that's playing, okay. And these are not people just off the street, but trained people in the field. You know, so I could tell you some name, you would immediately recognize it. Also, the phantom imaging is very similar, precise, and the only difference, and that doesn't immediately jump out at you, but over extended listening to realize that there is more depth to the sound stage with a dipole than with a monopole. What's surprising also to me is that these two loudspeakers that I'm comparing here is the dipole was built sort of an all-out effort using the best drivers that I knew how to find, while the monopole, since it was only an experiment, I say, well, let me find some drivers that I think are pretty decent because I was really looking for something else. And it turns out that despite the huge cost difference in terms of the drivers, you can't tell. That's another important thing there, which these days makes me believe that what I have pursued for many years very much to reduce distortion, both nonlinear and linear distortion, stored energy and so, there is a level that is good enough provided you do other things correctly, okay? Distortion certainly shows up, but only when many other things are also not right. So then this is just one more thing there. But if you do things right, then it is not as critical, at least as I thought the distortion was going to be. And the other nice thing that occurs is that with this type, both types of loudspeakers, both the loudspeakers disappear. Like if you listen with closed ears, so there is no sense that, oh, there's this loudspeaker, there's that loudspeaker, left and right. But also the room itself. Because the sound stage extends beyond the walls. And that does not end up like with a recording. Some people say, oh, yeah, since the speakers are a meter out from the room, or in my case, they are 2 meters out of the room, the maximum depth of sound stage is going to be 2 meters because that's where the fireplace is, that's where the wall is. Not so. You play a recording that was done outdoors, a big meadow, big open space there. There is no wall back there. There's no fireplace out there. The sound extends in depth beyond that. Okay, so the room is taken out of the picture. Now, this I have to really say, when I observed this, was sort of surprising thing. I didn't expect this. I wasn't looking for that. And it was really startling. And I asked, how is that possible? Well, I think I really try to study up on psychoacoustics and what's known, what experiments people have done. And there is, I think, a key piece here is that in our mind, we are able to segregate the sound as it occurs in time into different streams. And to give you an example here, if I had a conversation with my wife here in front and you were all chatting, well, this may be a little bit crowded there, but let's see, there were three or four people also talking. This, by the way, what I'm talking about is called the cocktail party effect there. We can talk to each other even when all these people around us are talking, having a conversation. But not only that, while we are talking, I could tune into the conversation that is going on over there. Okay, picking up enough pieces to put together a stream of sounds there that makes sense. Now, this is a cognitive process. It's something that happens in our brain there. Very difficult to do with a computer to sort out the thing. People with hearing aids have great difficulty doing that type of thing. It's a stream segregation, and we use cues due to the onset of sounds, the timbre, pretty much all the characteristics, duration of sounds, loudness, directions. We have the ability to change our acoustic horizon. It is variable. And I'm sure you have experienced that you can be concentrated on something and not hear what's going on around you. But you can also switch it off and then focus on something else. In other words, the distance of your acoustic horizon, it's variable. And if you haven't seen these references, these three references that I give you, I think they make fascinating reading. I'm reading right now this book here, This Is Your Brain on Music by Daniel Levitin. I heard him speak a few weeks ago in New York at the AAS convention. It was absolutely fascinating. He is at McGill University in Canada and does a lot of research, brain research there on what happens in the brain, which parts are active or so. And he had wonderful examples there. And the book, I think, is absolutely fascinating. There's also a book that came out this year by Barry Blesser and Linda Ruth Salter, I think is the first name, came out this year, Spaces Speak, Are You Listening? Which deals with the whole issue of space, room, and how we deal with it, not just today, but historically in different cultures, how we listen to spaces. And the stream analysis concept, I don't know if Bregman was the one who introduced it first there, but his book, I recommend read the introduction. I think you get enough of it. It gets very deep in there, so I never got beyond the introductory chapter there, but I think I sort of got the gist of the whole thing. Now, all of this, I think, relates back to the evolution of our hearing, the evolution of spatial hearing in life forms, not just in humans, but in animals as well. Hearing is a very important mechanism for survival. For survival, if there is a threat to survival, you want to know from where is it coming and how far away is it. How much time do I have to run or hide or whatever, right? So direction and distance are very important. So we are highly attuned to those cues that tell us direction and distance there. And more than that, we have to be able to pick out those cues under very different conditions, like whether it's out in the open savanna where you have few reflections, little reverberation, or whether it's in a forest where there are lots of reflections, the sound just bounces around. You still have to be able to localize and tell the distance and pick out the cues there. And we know a lot of from psychoacoustic research what those cues are. But, and here's the important thing, as species, you have to be able to do that in the different situations, in different environments, and sort it out, and then basically you can ignore the environment. And I think this is what is happening also in today in a living room, where you have the direct sound that you use to create this illusion, but you have also the reflections. Now, the reflections don't tell you anything new if they have the same spectral content like the direct sound. That's a very important point. If the spectral content is the same, then it is like, oh, reflection from there, or it's just a copy of what I heard coming from here, from the direct sound, but it's from there. It's just copies. They're delayed copies. And we actually use them to increase intelligibility. There's also research has been done there that you have to have a certain amount of reflection in rooms, like in lecture rooms or so, to improve intelligibility. So the idea that you often read about there is that, well, you don't want reflection, you want to have absorbers, everything should be as dead as possible. That will give you the most accurate sound reproduction. No. Because you're not counting for what is happening between the ears there, which has evolved over, out of necessity, over, I don't know, millions of years probably. Yeah, long time. Now, a lot of this here has been studied, and you have heard the terms like the precedence effect, the precedence effect in a room in particular. We know that if you have a direct and reflected sound, they are heard as a single entity from the location of the direct sound. The Haas effect, very well known, the integration of a direct sound with a delayed sound to add loudness. I mean, this is very much exploited in many rooms and halls and concert halls, churches. And an effect, which is also part of the precedence effect, de-reverberation, at least I hadn't seen much about this, but this effect is that we are normally not much aware of reverberated sound, even when its energy is larger than that of the direct sound. The picture that I showed you earlier, the direct sound in all the reflections, where the energy in all these reflections, because they don't decay immediately, the energy in there is bigger than what is in the direct sound. Yet, it doesn't necessarily disturb us. So, I pushed the wrong button, and let me find here back where we were. Okay, the precedence effect. Oh, and there is, I think we also need to add another model that also relates, is Günter Theil's association model. Don't know if you have heard about it, but a simple example of how the association model is the following experiment. Again, if I'm speaking to a person here right now, we're having a conversation, and I sort of form a mental picture of what she sounds like. And she's talking, and as I'm turning my head like this here, so the sound comes from one ear and around the head into the other ear. The head-related transfer function greatly changes the sound pressure at the two different ears. Yet her timbre doesn't change. It still is the same. And the concept here is that we have sound coming, the outer ear shapes the sound. There is sort of a filtering function, which we know is a head-related transfer function, depending on the angle there. But we perceive the whole situation. So as I turn my head, we recognize that the head, in perception, we know the head is turning. So an inverse filter, he calls this M-1, is pulled in, which compensates for the change in actually what you would actually measure at the eardrums. So timbrally, it sounds the same. And then out of the whole thing, we recognize the gestalt, you know, what the whole situation really was. This model is, I think it's slowly also being adopted, what I heard recently by some of the, how should I say, more authoritative figures in the field, like Jens Blauert, you know, spatial hearing. He is finally also apparently saying that, yeah, this type of model is necessary to explain certain phenomena in hearing. Okay, so enough of that. And let me sum up what I've said here so far. Basically, that it is with two-channel playback in a normal living space, we can provide an experience that is fully satisfying, where the loudspeakers in the room disappear and the illusion of listening into a different space takes over. And I think if you experience this, it just sounds very natural and very accurate, but you have to have the right loudspeakers. And so let me talk just a few words about the loudspeakers here. I said omnidirectional and dipole. And what does it take to build, for instance, an omnidirectional loudspeaker? Basically, it has to do with the size. Here's a graph. Horizontal axis is frequency, vertical axis is millimeter, from 001 to 1,000 millimeters, 1 meter. And you have to, as a rule of thumb, don't quote me here on preciseness, but leave the diameter of, say, your, here's a box loudspeaker with a piston. The diameter of this piston should be less than a quarter wavelength. Okay, that's so that this source here can radiate omnidirectional and not start beaming. If we draw the distance for a quarter wavelength, it's this line here, which would be a meter at 85 hertz, or translate to 4.2 millimeter at 20 kilohertz. So if I use the 12-inch driver, which has an effective diameter of 240 millimeter, I can use it, say, up to 200 hertz and stay below this quarter wavelength line there. Well, if I wanted to generate 105 dB SPL at 1 meter in free space, just to pick a number here, okay? This is quite loud, but I think it's also a level that one should be able to achieve in a system that I would claim accurate, you know, because it's also important that the volume level reaches somewhat realistically into what real life sound like there. There are the reasons for that. Then you look at the displacement that this cone would have to make, and you find that down here at, what is it, 60 hertz or so, you get 10 millimeters X max, and that's pretty much all you can hope for. And so there's a region here where you run out of maximum displacement. If you look at a 6-inch driver here, which you might combine with your 12-inch, here's an excursion from the 6-inch driver. And again, the low end will be a problem. And when you look at the tweeter, here's a 1-inch tweeter, nominal 1-inch tweeter, 30 millimeter effective diameter. You see that it exceeds this quarter wavelength requirement. Now, if it's a soft dome, it will actually change its radiating effective diameter. It will become smaller because it doesn't radiate as a piston at higher frequencies. But you can see that it's difficult to build a small enough driver for very high frequencies. And again, X max becomes a problem at the low end. The box, of course, itself, certainly the frontal area here has to be also small compared to the quarter wavelength. So you end up with small drivers, relatively speaking, and large excursion. And that's typically a problem because large excursion usually means large distortion also. Now, you've seen how I did this in the case of the monopole here. Here's the 5-inch driver crossed over at 100 kilohertz to the tweeter. And this box, this is the interesting thing. It's a pipe. Okay, you see it here. It's just a piece of PVC pipe. It's closed at the end, so it resonates like an organ pipe. You know, it's very predictable resonances. But as it turns out, if you provide stuffing in there, if you just the right amount and distribution in there, you can actually build a very good termination to the wave that radiates from the back of the cone down here, gets reflected, comes back up here, comes back out the cone again, right? To the point where this wave, this rearward wave, as it goes back and comes out again, is 40 dB down from compared to the direct sound. And again, with the tone burst measurements, you can measure this very nicely, because the reflected wave has taken longer time, so I can look at the direct signal and the reflected signal and measure the amplitude difference between the two there. 40 dB return loss to anyone who is into microwaves or transmission line, that's a pretty decent return loss, and it's a 1% reflection factor. That's not too shabby. So this, even though it's a box speaker, it's a boxless speaker, because the pipe here is enormously stiff, so it's not going to have panel resonances like your rectangular box is likely to have. The woofer is just a rectangular box, but it's so small that you can make it stiff enough that these panels here basically don't contribute any sound. And the tweeter I pointed out earlier, eventually it becomes forward directional, but it goes down to 1 kHz, and you don't find that many tweeters that can go down to such low frequency, have large enough cushion. Now, the dipole here, the requirements are different for a dipole. Again, a similar graph. Dipole you can build just as a piston in a flat baffle here. And then you have to be careful. The rear wave here is out of phase with the front wave. And when this pairs here becomes half a wavelength, then you get cancellation between the front wave. If it's a half wavelength, you get addition. But once it's the wavelengths here, then you get cancellation. So just order of magnitude speaking, this distance should be less than the wavelengths. And here you have on the graph, you see that. You can also build the dipole in form of an H-frame. Here is, again, the piston. And we increase the pass length like this around. And this pass length should be less than half wavelengths. Why is this half wavelength when this here is one wavelength? Well, what happens is you have basically a waveguide, acoustic waveguide, and here you have an opening of the waveguide, and you get a reflection because there is an impedance mismatch here. So you set up a quarter wavelength resonance, and that pretty much limits the upper frequency end of this type of arrangement. Okay, that's a problem with this one here. Okay. Now, there is also a third way to build a source that has uniform polar response, and that's a cardioid loudspeaker. Some people have made it, and you can build it simply as a summation of a coincident omni source and a dipole source. You know, a cardioid is nothing more than 1/2, which is an omni here, plus 1/2 cosine alpha, which is a dipole. The two together give you the cardioid response. Could be built as a gradient speaker. You take two omni sources, space it some distance apart, and delay the electrical signal to one of the sources by T equals D over C. Makes you a gradient loudspeaker. Olson writes about these things. Or you can build it as a resistance box, and a number of people have done that. You have basically a closed box with slits in them or with openings, and the opening is covered with usually with some cloth. And that, so you form a resistive capacitive low-pass filter. The capacitor is a compliance of the air in the box, and the covered slot is a resistance. The tricky thing is that resistance has to be 411 newton seconds per meter to the cubed, which is the free space impedance, acoustic impedance of free space. And that you can do, like I said, with cloths with certain weaves and densities there. But when you, if you want to do this for a woofer, where you have large air volumes moving, it's very difficult to find a material that doesn't flop around, that stays linear, that is a linear flow resistor. Now, there are, when I looked into this, I found there is actually in a totally different field. I looked in the field of chemical filters. You know, chemists have to filtrate fluids and things. And they build filters that actually work in these resistance ranges with flow resistances. And the best that I found is a metal felt, which is basically metal sort of woven together that it looks like a felt. It's maybe this thick here. It lets air through. It's also used for filtration purposes, but also as lining in ducts. Or as a, if you want to build a heater, which has a flame that covers a very large surface. So you have gas coming on one side, and you have a very uniform gas flow, controlled, reduced velocity flow on the other side. You get a very uniform, large flame, you know, surface covered with flame. That thing works actually quite well for this type of application. But again, for a woofer, you have to move large amounts of air, so that's a problem. So there, this one here is probably the best solution, or the gradient. But this one here I've seen work, both of them I've seen working models. But basically I asked myself the question, what for? Is it really necessary to build a cardioid? It's basically a dipole and I haven't seen really advantages of that. Okay, so let's just for a moment look at my claim number two, that you have to have uniform polar response. The spectrum of reflection should be the same like the direct sound. You place this loudspeaker symmetrical, and the reflection have to be delayed. And what are the current practices? You look at the typical loudspeaker today. 95% of the loudspeaker, I would say, are boxes. They are omni at low frequencies. They are forward directional at high frequencies. So they will not do what I'm talking to you about. You look at loudspeaker setups. Often by necessities, loudspeakers are put into corners against the wall. So that also is not a good thing. Room treatments. People absorb sound because it supposedly dense the room. But rarely are these room treatment materials broadband. All these foam type things that work above maybe 800 hertz or so, but don't do anything at low frequencies. People put things on the floor, and that doesn't do much except at high frequencies, where probably the tweeter doesn't illuminate the floor much to begin with because it's a directional system. Then we talk about room equalization, and these days with digital signal processing, and since it seems so obvious that all you need to do is to equalize the sound at the listening position, I take a very skeptical view of electronic room equalization. Because fundamentally, you are dealing now with a processor between your ears, which has adapted over millions of years with a situation that you're trying to correct with DSP. And so far, and we're not quite smart enough on how to approach this. And I feel some confirmation in that, because when you look at the papers that are being written about room equalization, the different approaches that people use, the different algorithms, most of them empirically sort of derived at, you said, well, we're experimenting, we're trying. We don't really know yet. You know, there's some more or less successful commercial products out there, and all they will do, they will all change what you hear. But are they really getting to the optimum? Yeah, they can make improvements, I grant you that. And I have heard some of these systems there. But to me, the ultimate test is when I spend time with a system. If I can listen to it long-term, over long periods of time, and not sort of feel, oh, I'm getting tired, I want to turn this thing off, something isn't right. I couldn't tell you what it is, But I take that as an indication that my brain, something is working hard up there to correct or compensate for something that doesn't seem natural. Then I know something isn't quite right yet. And so far, most systems have struck me that like that. And that includes also surround systems, even though I've heard demos that were super impressive, but I've the majority of surround systems, I say, yeah, they're sort of maybe impressive for a little while, but then you say, it's not quite there. Okay. Oh, and I should, of course, say recording techniques. That's one of the things that you find in, like, in a two-channel system. You become extremely aware of the recorded acoustics, the venue acoustics there, and whether that's a real acoustic or whether it's a synthesized acoustics, you know, whether there were too many microphones used, whether the whole space hangs together. And usually I find live recordings do a better job than studio recordings in this respect here. But recording technique is certainly an important parameter. Two-channel stereo versus surround sound, I just hinted at it. What you are missing in two channels is a real surround, because even if you get a good sound stage, it is always in front of you. It may extend beyond the loudspeakers, depending on the recording there, but it's sort of in front of you and in depth and height. It also has height. And I feel what I'm getting, and I've experimented with surround quite a bit there, but I always go, after a while, I say, well, it's not worth the effort, what I'm getting here. I get more believability if I listen just to two-channel stereo. Get greater satisfaction, and that's sort of just a feeling type term. And it's impressive in its simplicity, basically. If you can set it up properly, it's pretty hard to get much simpler than that. Okay, so that's the message here that I want to leave with you. Oops, why do I jump always to, okay. And so that's what I wanted to relate to you. Thank you for your attention. And if you have any questions, be happy to answer them, if I can.
Yes. It's impossible to put the speakers. Oh, sorry. Thank you. If you have a small room where it's impossible to create that distance of 1 meter,
yeah,
from the side walls and the back, given the problems of broadband absorption, what do you do? Because you're always going to have those annoying reflections. So do you,
yeah,
have any thoughts or suggestions on the way to go with that?
Yeah, I mean, you point out very rightly that these requirements that I have, certain distances from the wall, sort of dictate a minimum room size, right? And if you are below that size there, what do you do then? What I have found is that an omnisource, not a dipole, but an omnisource is surprisingly benign in terms of that this 1 meter distance that I talked about, you can violate that. The symmetry is still an important factor. I have a situation like this in one of my rooms there where I have set up the Plutos there, where I cannot set it up symmetrically, it just is no way. And the whole zone stage is sort of pulled over to one side, and you have to set unsymmetrical to get a more uniform spread. And it's also not the distance from the wall behind it. But other than that, it works quite well. And the other requirement is you may want to sit closer than your equilateral triangle, actually closer than that. So the loudspeakers become more like giant headphones. The other thing is when you have an omnisource, you don't have to go very far from the source for it to be truly omni. Like this Pluto that I showed you there, when I make measurements, I make a frequency response measurement 6 inches from the tweeter, okay, which is not that much. Then I double the distance to 12 inches, okay. Double that again to 24 inches. And just as you would expect, the response drops 60 B every step, every time I double the distance. And the frequency response stays the same. It's the same response. So you can get really close to this thing, and it basically becomes a giant headphone.
Thank you.
But without the in-the-head localization type issues. Yeah.
I just wondered if you'd done any experiment with dipoles, for example. I'm thinking of the quantum electrostatics. Have you done any work on with more exotic transducers, or what's your feeling on this?
No, I haven't done, but I have to say that the electrostatics, in particular the quad ESL63, has been sort of an inspiration to me for a long, long time, and was thought, geez, there's something right about this speaker. I don't know what it is. This goes back. Today, I think I know what it is, but the fascination with it. But it also has limitations, as you know. It's very touchy sweet spot, and the dynamic range, and so it's somewhat limited. And I always said, gosh, can't we do better than that? Overcome those limitations without losing what is obviously something really right about them. And I think it can be done. The problem, let me add this. I think that the quad is an exception, the ESL63. There are many large panel type electrostatics or magnetic type, planar type speakers. They are well known to be touchy in terms of setup in the room. And I think that is because inherently they have a very non-uniform polar response, despite what people may want to tell you. Okay, even the ESL63 is not really that pretty when I've seen measurements that were done. I think it was either Archimedes or Eureka project that used the ESL63 in there. But still, they have enough of the right stuff to point the direction.
I found your observations very interesting, but I'd like to add some more to support wall mounting when you have to use wall mounting for hard speakers. This business of you learning the acoustic of a room and you can then remove it from your consciousness and listen to the reproduced music. The first impression of wall mount speakers is that there is a wall attached to the soundstage and that you don't hear depth beyond the wall. But in fact, you learn the wall sound within about 20 minutes. And if you continue listening, the perception of the wall begins to fade and you start to recreate the original soundstage impression in your brain. So you can process out the wall boundary. I agree there is an initial unmistakable unnaturalness about wall mounting. But if the speakers are designed for that boundary and provide a reasonably even spectral response on and off axis, then the results can be satisfying. It's a learned experience, but is not one to be dismissed entirely.
Okay, that's very interesting that you say that. I have to say I have not built in wall speakers, so I don't. I can speak only from what I have heard.
I've had to design some which have to survive wall mounting.
Yeah,
and it is.
Yeah. Now the observation that you make there, it takes 20 minutes or so to adapt to this there. I noticed in comparing the two types of speakers that I had here, when you switch between them instantly, one should not make any judgments or so, because it takes, I could actually sense how something is happening here to sort of adapt to a new situation, because clearly the two speakers illuminate the room differently there. And it's sort of like the processor here between the ears has to change its algorithm or something so that I can make a valid, before I can make a valid comparison. So there's definitely a learning process. There's definitely, you walk into any room, there's immediately a learning process. We may not think about it, But we learn about the room acoustics. And we process it, and we can then, from then on, filter it out. So that's interesting, the observation there. That
follow.
Yeah. Yeah.
40 minutes, I began to forget the cathedral acoustic,
yeah,
except as a background, and I could concentrate on this distant quartet.
Yeah.
Way buried.
Yeah. 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 It's. I think it's absolutely phenomenal what we are able to do there, and I think we should really exploit it. You know, like consciously design for it or so.
Siegfried, I've got a rhetorical question, really, and that is anybody going to listen this time? Because this message, the message that you should have full spectrum reflections, is not a new one.
Yeah.
People have been saying this for 30 years and more. I actually brought a quote with me from an article that appeared in the JES by Daniel Queen in May 1979.
Yeah.
And it was entitled The Effect of Loudspeaker Radiation Patterns on Stereo Imaging and Clarity.
Yeah.
And he said, part of his conclusion was, the data suggests that to achieve good imaging and clarity, loudspeaker designs for home music listening rooms must consider directivity not from the standpoint of audience coverage, but from the standpoint of uniformity of the intensity of arriving inflections, reflections with respect to frequency. Now, I did some experiments along the lines you hinted at with using thin foam absorbers on the side of the room, which was supposed to improve the sound, and of course didn't in the 1980s. And I've been preaching the method, the message of needing full bandwidth reflections, particularly sidewall reflections, in UK hi-fi magazines ever since then. Maybe it's because I've been saying it, but I haven't noticed anybody taking any notice. there are a few people who apparently have, not due to what I've said, I think, but because they sat in on the experiments that you've referred to that took place in the Technical University of Denmark anechoic chamber, when KEF and B&O were simulating room reflections with speaker layouts there.
Yeah.
If you buy a Dali loudspeaker today, for example, you'll find that they recommend that you fire it straight down the room, and they design it specifically that way so that the angle you are off axis and the angle of the first sidewall reflection off axis are not very different, therefore their spectrums are about the same. And I'm pretty sure that's because Peter Lingdorf, who is one of the company founders, sat in on some of the, he's Danish, sat in on some of those experiments and heard for himself the effect of having full spectrum reflections, particularly from the sidewall. Yeah. That experience is there. People have been saying this for a long time. Is you saying it going to make any difference?
I don't know. I mean, it's in audio. We're rediscovering lots of things here after 30 years or so that people have done before there. The particular experiments that you mentioned here with what was that, the Archimedes or Eureka project? I don't know which one of the two.
I think it's called Archimedes, but it's Eureka was the original program.
I see.
It's
the way
the
European Union put money. Yeah. I just had some conversation with, I can't think of his name, but anyways, the Biolab 5 loudspeaker is sort of the outcome of that research, or considered that. And I would, a comment that I would make on it, I've heard the Biolab 5 there, and it is definitely a step in the right direction, but in my opinion, it didn't go far enough. Yeah, it's definitely in the right. And what I would take as put as a criticism to those experiments that were done then is that the experiment was done on a too simple case. Having few reflections is not, you cannot necessarily jump from that to the case where, like a room like here where you have way more reflection, which of course is very difficult to study, so it's fully understandable. You want to work with just single or just a few reflections. Yeah. And if I hope it, I don't sound like I discovered something or so that may not have been known. It's just, to me, I would have to say, I was quite excited when I made this observation. And yeah, there are papers have been written. Daniel Green Davis wrote a paper on polar response of loudspeakers. I mean, it's certainly, I'm sure people have recognized this before, but it hasn't gotten through. I think on a commercial standpoint, to build a dipole is not a really effective, efficient way of building loudspeakers. You know, you have an acoustic short circuit. You're throwing away sound. You're moving air that doesn't seem to do anything, right? So it's not a good way of building loudspeakers. And an omni is, yeah, you have to be careful, but I don't think you can get close enough there to really do. But there are very few people who really build omni loudspeakers. There's some. Yeah.
The wall mounting thing, I design, among other things, control rooms for recording studios. Okay, the big difference between the domestic listening situation and the control room is that you'll have a person sitting, or one or two people sitting at the mixing desk, and usually some other people who've got a need to hear the same spectral balance of sound sitting at the back of the room. Mm-hmm. So the sweet spot is undesirable. Mm-hmm. You actually must try to guarantee that the people at the control desk and the people at the back of the room get exactly the same impression, yeah, not only in amplitude, but in other respects. Now, a classic case of problems in a control room that I meet very often is loudspeakers mounted just in front of the window into the studio. And the delayed reflections from the glass arrive just late enough to smear the step function image, the transients, at all listening positions from the desk back. And this gives the classical situation of very poor stereo localization and unclear HF. And if you add HF to make it a little bit brighter, it just goes harder. In such a situation, I've usually mounted the speakers in the walls, because then I also treat the walls with at least 2 inches of foam, so that any reflections that come off are lower frequencies. And this always gives a much better transient response, which means better stereo imaging, a sweeter top. It actually gives apparently more high frequency than the previous, than the faulty. And that impression is consistent from the listening position at the desk to the back wall. But if there was an alternative way of doing this, I'd be interested in it as well.
I don't really know. I mean, I look at living rooms there, but recording studios, the few that I have been into, which had these soffit-mounted monitors above the window, and there it was mostly, the aim was to get high enough SPL level, because the musician want to hear what they're playing at the level that they performed it, which to me is ear damaging, so only listen with.
I once said to a rock and roll musician who said to me, why do my speakers at home sound better than the ones in the control room, which I just spent 2 hours setting up? And I said, because you can have a good speaker or a loud speaker. You cannot have a good loud speaker.
Since we're talking about domestic conditions, you're very lucky. Your fireplace is at one end of the room. I don't know what things like in the States, but over here, many living rooms have the fireplace built out in the long wall, whereas there isn't room to position speakers in front of it. So the speakers have to go at the short wall end.
Yeah.
The result being, of course, you've got a very unsymmetrical arrangement of the walls. Is there a way around that?
Well, at this point, all from my experience, I would say is to use an omni source and listen to it fairly close. And actually, these monopole speakers that I showed here, the idea behind those was that I have amplifiers, everything is built in, so and they're fairly light, that if you live in a small apartment or small room where you can't place them optimally, normally, but if you want to listen and serious listen, you just take them and put them into place because they weigh 16 pounds or so each there, so it's nothing that can put them out of the way and then pull them in the right spot. I think there's always, for every room, there is one spot. It may not be aesthetically the best spot for them to stay permanently, but maybe temporarily.
Talking of omni speakers, sorry if I'm
cutting in. You've got a low battery sign up. You're likely to lose everything if you don't switch off.
Oh, it doesn't charge. Don't understand. Huh. Well, so it may go away here in a moment.
Talking of
the 5-degree angle. But when it switches to the dipole, whoops, I just hear this, the closest speaker, and not that much from the other speaker. From the room, you mean? I don't think so. I think that's it's a whole long thing, subject, maybe not to discuss off the side.
I believe you are a DIY audio forum member. Is that correct?
No.
DIYaudio.com. No, there's a thread on there in the Pass section, Nelson Pass section, that asks, can the Orion electronic crossover be improved upon by going discrete components, and we were wondering, and Nelson Pass had offered to look into that, and we were wondering if you could give your blessing to that for DIY use.
I mean, it's a DIY, so you're welcome to do whatever you
like. Well, in respect to you also offering the crossover on the Linkvitz Lab website, I mean, there would be no...
Yeah.
We wouldn't... Nobody would be stepping on your toes, so to speak.
Oh, I see. You're saying someone is building a crossover and calls it an Orion crossover or something.
Well, something...
Yeah, I would be a little sensitive maybe,
right,
if you called it Orion. If you want to call it something else, fine.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically, my answer is if you do some variation on the theme, fine. You know, this right. is certainly not the only way to skin the cat.
Yeah.
But just don't call it Orion, you know, it's something else.
If we needed your collaboration, could we communicate with you through the Orion users website? Would that be?
I have to tell you, quite frankly, I these days I rarely go on and look at these do-it-yourself.
Well, you were there
forums.
You were there a couple of weeks ago.
I was there a couple of weeks ago. On which forum is it?
On the Orion users.
Oh, the Orion users group. There. Mm. Yeah, there I look periodically. I look in there.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, I misunderstood.
No, right.
DIY,
I was talking about two different
there's
things.
There's a DIY. There are so many different forums there that I really don't follow what's going on there.
Okay. And another question is, I really like electrostatic loudspeakers, and I have listened to the ESL 63s.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate further on what is it an electrostatic needs? How would I minimize the bad effects? If somebody was building an electrostatic from scratch, what is good about the 63? What's bad about it?
Make it smaller. the tweeter on the ESL 63 is about this size, right? So that's a little bit too big there. At low frequencies, you can move only so much air with it, and that's just inherent in the whole thing. You know. They're just Mother Nature sets certain limitations if you want to reproduce sound with an electrostatic. The electrostatic forces are weak, so you need very low mass diaphragms there. It's not that the low mass and speed and all these things are the magic of an electrostatic. No, that's just a necessity. Otherwise, you wouldn't get much sound from them.
Yeah. Have you heard the new iteration of the quad electrostatic loudspeaker, the brand new one?
As a matter of fact, a local store had one of those. I don't exactly, it's a three-digit number.
I think it's a four-digit number now.
Is it four? No, I haven't heard the four-digit number, but the three-digit number, and at that time I had the Pluto, and I had it in my car from some other demo, and I took it in the store, and now the people really well, and I set it up. And they sort of laughed, and what have you done here with these sewer pipes and stuff? And then I said, okay, let me just put it here right next to your quartz there, and let's just listen. You pick some music that you like to demo, and we turn it on. And pretty soon the salespeople came over and said, in particular the one guy, Craig, I know him really well, he said, there's something wrong here. There's something wrong. This is not how our quads sound like, you know. Sort of like. And from my observation was, the Pluto stood up extremely well, if not, you know, as least as good as the quads that I heard there. So.
Siegfried, I have both your loudspeakers at home,
yeah.
And I agree that they sound virtually identical, especially as in my case they're in different rooms. But there is a difference in depth. Now there are two differences between these. One's a dipole, one's a monopole. Mm-hmm. But the other big difference, as I know, is in the cost of the components.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea, would you care to speculate to what extent that difference in terms of depth of stereo staging is down to the monopole-dipole difference, or just simply that the components in the Pluto are so much cheaper and the nonlinear distortion is presumably much higher, etc.?
Well, my take on that is that the Pluto, yes, the drivers are cheaper there, but they are not bad drivers there, right? They are not of the same distortion performance as the one in the Orion there. But they appear to be good enough, you know, whatever that means, good enough. There's sort of a threshold that when you're below that, it's okay.
Yeah, but then we're also talking about stage depth that is good enough.
I don't know what the reason is for the stage depths, and I sometimes wonder whether the greater stage depths with the Orion, with the dipole, whether that's an illusion, whether that is less realistic than with a monopole. Sometimes I think the monopole is more precise in that respect. When I sort of try to visualize how far were the microphones from the actual sources, the dipole may give you an artificial depth, which is not unpleasing because it gives you a sense of a larger space there, but it may be a distortion. Yeah, I don't know.
I was just going to say, one point that strikes me is very similar with the performance of a monopole speaker is that of measuring or listening to a speaker in a wall or a true baffle. In both cases, you get the reflection. If it's a hard, solid wall or baffle, you get the reflections in time all the way through. So you end up with the same situation as you were describing earlier with the key things were everything to be in time with each other and consistent in the frequency band. Surely building speakers into a wall automatically gives you that.
I'm not sure I followed. If I build a loudspeaker in the wall here, I made it flush with the wall. okay? Then the sound emanates from here. There is no reflection, no first reflection. The sound has to hit something else, come back, and then get reflected. There is really no reflection. It really is a point, a radiating point in the surface here.
Yeah, precisely. And if one of the key factors in the what you were saying earlier is avoiding those reflections and the inconsistencies and the changes of them with boundaries and that sort of thing, surely one of the simplest ways of doing it is build the bugger into the wall. Then you've killed that problem at source.
Well, look at it this way. If I have this wall here, there are no first reflections coming off the wall. All I get is later reflection, floor, ceiling, white, sidewalls, or so. So as I'm sitting out there, my perceptual system is somehow telling me there's something strange, possibly strange out here, because there is all these other things here behave like I would expect for a room, but this thing here is not behaving the same way as a source would behave when I listen to it inside the room. And when you said that it takes like 40 minutes to adapt to the situation, I think what's happening is the processor here between the ears is saying, but I can handle this. It just takes me a little bit here to overcome that.
The first impression is that it sounds completely flat. There's
yeah.
No image depth.
Yeah.
And the focus is poor as well.
Yeah.
You learn the boundary and its relationship of that radiation to the rest of the environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And eventually the acoustic of the recording reappears slowly.
Yeah.
Once you've learned it remains satisfying.
Yeah, I totally can believe that. Yeah. Yeah.
Just sort of back to the placement idea and things. I just wondered with terrible speaker because of the way the reflections are. The symmetry was a point that you said was important. But with terrible speaker placement, is there still a benefit to having or a significant benefit to having something like an Omni or a dipole? I'm just thinking from a sort of consumer point of view when they're just going to put it wherever they're going to fit in the room.
From my observation so far, there is definitely an advantage. Even when you can't place them optimally, to do at least the source right. To put it extreme fashion, my take these days is the problem is not the room. The problem is the loudspeaker. And when you go to a hi-fi store and you listen to a speaker and you like it and they say, but you know when I take it home, it may sound different. Yeah, it probably will sound different. But the reason why it sounds different is not because your room is different, because a loudspeaker was the wrong source to begin with. And that's one of the things that I've learned from the Orion, the dipole speaker there. I have numerous responses from people that basically confirm exactly the same things that I have been telling what the thing will do. Independent confirmation in very different rooms. Like Don Berenger is a good friend of mine who works on the East Coast, so we're long distance apart, but we're on the phone a lot. And he has a pair of Orions and Pluto's or so. And he is a former recording engineer for the U.S. Marine Band. He hears different than I do. We agree on that. I mean, he listens for different things. He's a trained musician, so I'm not. And we listen for different things or so. But we come up with the same conclusions, independent of each other. And we challenge each other, right, to keep each other honest, I say it right. It's so easy in sound to imagine things. It's someone has said, if I suggest something, what you're going to hear, you know, I give you a demo, and I tell you what you're going to hear, it's almost impossible for you not to hear what I told you are going to hear. It's a thing that salespeople in high-end audio stores use to great effect, you know, to sell you cables and spikes and all sorts of stuff. It's very difficult. I mean, it's honest. People really hear things. It's a whole thing. It's happening between your ears. There is no sound. There are only air particles vibrating. There are air particles impinging on your eardrums. That's all. And now you're trying to make sense out of this. Now, it took a few million years to make some things out of those air particles. You know, like the Zen saying, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody is around to hear it, does it make any sound? No, it doesn't make any sound. Sound is just an illusion, as is seeing, pictures, color. There's no color. It's totally construct in your head. I highly recommend this book, This Is Your Brain on Music. It's absolutely fascinating, you know, what we have learned very recently, you know, in the last 10 years or so about perception and what goes on. It's just amazing. So when I say we are creating an illusion, we are very good at creating illusions, filling in the missing pieces. Okay? It's much better to leave things out than to add things there, because the brain can fill in what's missing. But if you put in too much wrong stuff or so, it's hard for it to get rid of it. The sins of omission are not too bad.
In the Pluto, you use a certain tube length for the tweeter. Is there a purpose for that extra volume? Can it be reduced a lot?
No, on the Pluto, the tweeter is just a mounting issue. Somewhere I had to mount it, and that the easiest way was just to use a tube there. And this particular tweeter is open in the back, okay? And it's actually, that causes the internals. It's not that pretty there. It causes pretty bad resonance there, and so there is absorbing material in the pipe, some amount, you know, behind the tweeter. And then there's electronic equalization also because of this.
Okay, good, because I sketched up some variations on the Pluto material, you know, the PVC pipe and on.
You need to have at least some volume behind behind the tweeter, maybe this much or so to do some absorbing.
Okay, and I was wondering if you'd be interested in seeing them. You had said on the Orion users website you were surprised that no one had gone ahead and altered the materials or the shape.
Yeah, I mean, the Orion... you speak the Orion,
I'm sorry, about the Plutos.
Yeah, the Pluto, I consider it sort of an open platform, and I was hoping to stimulate some thinking, and people try to do the same thing. You know? I mean, if you understand what the basic concept and principle is, you can use different diameter pipes, but with the limits, right? And different lengths and stuff like this. Okay. Yes, I'm sorry.
I'd like to thank you very sincerely for coming over, talking to us, giving us such a good talk.
Thank you.